Tonight, in our lecture series in which historians take aim at figures in Irish history of whom they heartily disapprove, it's the turn of one of the great bêtes noires of Irish nationalism, the Unionist leader Edward Carson. The speaker, with Carson in his sights, is Senator Martin Manser, son of the distinguished historian Nicholas Manser. The senator has a DPhil from Oxford and was head of research for Fianna Fáil under three Taoiseach, Charles Haughey, Albert Reynolds and Bertie Ahern. Just as Edward Carson was one of the principal architects of Irish partition, Martin Manser has been a champion of reconciliation through his important work on the Northern peace process. The title of his paper tonight is Edward Carson and the Last Ditch Stand of the Ascendancy.
The title is taken from a much respected historian, A.T.Q. Stewart's The Ulster Crisis, Resistance to Home Rule, 1912-14, first published in 1967. The exact quotation is, "The ascendancy had undeniably chosen Ulster as the ditch they would make their last stand in." And he goes on to make the very valid point that, quote, "a religion was the dynamic in Ulster and not merely a cloak for other motives. Historians have sometimes underestimated it, but politicians never." Indeed, it is not entirely without significance that 90 years on, the principal leader of the Unionist community is the Reverend Ian Paisley, who made his reputation as a radical religious firebrand in the tradition of the Reverend Henry Cook, but equally seeing himself as the successor of Carson. Much of the religious factor may have been perception. Stewart wrote, and he was writing in 1967, "The Protestants' fears about a Dublin Parliament may have been exaggerated, and the history of Ireland since independence has on the whole tended to suggest that they were, but they did not think so at the time, and it was upon that belief that they acted." End of quote. There were, of course, class interests, economic interests, and among Ulster Unionists at least, the sense of a sharply differing national identity and ethnic origin. Despite the title of this series, only a few historical characters are unequivocally and unremittingly bad. I do not claim that Carson belongs to their number. I propose to adopt as the structure for this address an extraordinary editorial that appeared in the Irish Times on the 23rd of October 1935 with the title Carson of Duncairn, the day after his death, which has value as a contemporary witness. The Irish Times at that time was still primarily the newspaper of the small Protestant and ex-Southern Unionist minority that had just come under one of its most famous editors, R.M. Smiley. I will provide further commentary and try to make it clear where I agree and indeed where I fundamentally disagree with what I presume was his assessment. The editorial was written from the point of view of the community from which Carson had sprung but had left behind, though he returned to it in spirit in his post-1921 political retirement. Events in which Carson had played a large part had left that community out on a limb, and consequently its principal newspaper voice could not share the valedictory enthusiasm of the Church of Ireland Primate in Armagh, C.F. Darcy, who in his funeral oration could laud Carson's role in the great struggle for Ulster, the fire of patriotism, the thrilling tone of his voice, and praise what the great leader did for the land he loved so well. Which land, one might ask, did the primate mean? Ulster or Ireland? The Irish Times editorial began on a starkly different note, and I quote, "Edward Carson's career was one of the tragedies of Irish history." The next, an extraordinarily shocking sentence, which all of us would strongly disagree with today, can only be understood in the context of its time, 1935. It read, "If he had been 40 years younger, Lord Carson might have been a British Hitler or even a Mussolini." In 1935, there was a section of right-wing opinion in these islands. Newspaper proprietor Lord Rothermere, who was incidentally the uncle of my aunt, to the fore, who admired strong leaders on the continent even though they engaged in histrionics and had no compunction about illegality. And although Sir Oswald Mosley, like Owen O'Duffy, had a certain following, and doubts about the efficacy or viability of democracy in both islands were quite widespread, there is no evidence that Britain at this period would have been susceptible to dictatorship from Carson or anyone else. The second half of the sentence claimed As it is, he has died at the age of 81 after a life crammed with great achievements and yet strangely barren of great results. End of quote. Carson himself might have largely shared that sentiment. He died feeling strongly unfulfilled and a disappointed and disillusioned man. Without, I sense anyway, the sort of paternal pride in Northern Ireland that one might have expected, especially given the homage he received there in the form of the magnificent statue outside the Parliament building at Stormont, unveiled in his presence in 1933. The editorial went on to claim Carson for the South, and I quote, "He was a Southern Irishman in every fibre of his being. To the end of his days, he preserved a rich Dublin brogue and in many ways was typical of the South. Yet he is being buried in Belfast and his whole political career was identified with the province of Ulster." His father was an architect and civil engineer involved in building many elegant houses in South Dublin and its suburbs that nowadays sell for large sums of money. He was briefly a member of Dublin Corporation from 1877, sitting as a Liberal Conservative. While he built a sewer along Marlborough Road at his own expense, the indictment made against Conservatives, whether Unionist or Nationalist, on the Corporation by Professor Mary Daly in her study at Dublin, The Deposed Capital, was their resistance to attempts to relieve gross overcrowding and to fund the most basic water and sanitary facilities, which gave Dublin pre-1914 the second highest infant mortality in Europe, because their priority was to keep down the tax burden on ratepayers. Those who nowadays talk up Ireland under the Union tend to forget the appalling social conditions, not to mention the decimation of the population of the island as a result not just of famine, but a laissez-faire British policy with more than a touch of moral vindictiveness. Ireland to this day being unique in Europe in having much less population than 160 years ago, though that may at last be about to correct itself. Deindustrialisation everywhere except the northeast, and finally the scandalous fact that till about 1900, the Irish periphery was subsidising the metropolitan centre rather than the other way round. The editorial went on to praise Carson's forensic prowess at the bar and the fact that he figured in nearly every cause célèbre. He first came to prominence as a prosecuting ally of the Chief Secretary, Arthur Balfour, at a time of vigorous reassertion of the Conservative landlord interest in response to the plan of campaign. Carson was in Mitchelstown in 1887 when the police fired into the crowd, though not directly a witness of what was dubbed the Mitchelstown Massacre. He became a fearless champion of the ascendancy to which he was connected through his mother, a Lambert, descended from one of Cromwell's generals. His court duel with his Trinity contemporary Oscar Wilde in 1895 proved the ruin of the genius, when in the words of Wilde's biographer Richard Ellman, Carson, quote, "marched mercilessly through his liaisons." It is not easy, however, to blame Carson for Wilde's imprudence. His defence of Dr. Jameson was less successful, though it is interesting to note that the raid, and indeed the Boer War afterwards, was all about trying to assert the superior rights of British citizens, regardless of where they were in a minority. The Irish Times went on to speak of Carson's wholehearted identification with the Unionist Party and credited him with marshalling opinion in northeast Ulster into an organised campaign. He certainly provided the inspiration. Others may, in the strict sense of the word, be better organisers. The paper continued, and I quote, "Edward Carson was the man who almost single-handed brought all the well-laid schemes of Asquith and Redmond to naught." Great efforts are made nowadays to obscure the truth of that judgment. A whole school of commentators uniting neo-unionists and neo-Redmondites would try to persuade us that it was P. Pearce and the calamity of the 1916 Rising that tragically frustrated the life work of John Redmond, rather than unionist resistance to home rule. James Craig's remark that he would rather live under the Kaiser than John Redmond has been conveniently forgotten. And what we never hear from such commentators is the logical follow-through, which even George V conceded in the early 1930s, that Unionist resistance to home rule in the era of John Redmond was totally over the top and tragically misguided. Let us examine the phenomenon, by no means confined to Ireland, of trying to maintain the hegemony of an imperially backed minority faced with the forces of nationalism and democracy. The ascendancy was always a minority, even within Protestantism. For the best part of three centuries, let us say from 1529 to 1829, though those are not necessarily the exact dates, Anglican conformity was made as far as possible the basis for distributing what became post-1690 a near monopoly of power, wealth and land. In the late 18th century, Protestant Ireland was even tempted to follow the rebellious example of America, but this foundered on the re-emergence of Catholic power, vividly highlighted by the 1798 rebellion. The Act of Union was a fuite en avant, a pact oiled by corruption between ruling elites that, had it been fully revealed, would have caused a scandal even by the standards of the late reign of George III. The Union in no way involved the mass of the people of Ireland and, on the contrary, was designed to preempt them from ever being able to assert majority rights in an island context. The Anglo-Irish elite, in contrast, were deeply attached to and greatly benefited from the British connection. Most members of the Church of Ireland, and especially its clerical, political and social leaders, had deep reservations about democracy if it meant conceding home rule or subjecting, in many cases, propertied Protestants to Catholic and nationalist majority rule. As Patrick Buckland concedes at the end of his book on Irish unionism, Outside of Ulster, regarding its negotiations with the new emerging order in 1922, its spokespersons were not Democrats. William Plunkett, Archbishop of Dublin, said at the time of the Second Home Rule Bill in April 1893 that the minority opposed to it, quote, represent the intelligence, the education and the standing of the people much more than the majority. The mere fact that some of the Irish people wish for it ought not surely to be sufficient reason for this concession. Very few, even among those who have voted for it, really care for home rule, end of quote. Bishop of Down and future primate C.F. Darcy wrote in 1912 of there never being in the minds of, quote, Irish Protestants so deep a dread of Roman aggression. Though only a quarter of the population, the bishop claimed they were, quote, by far the most energetic portion of the inhabitants, a fact which politicians may well lay to heart. Erskine Childers, then a moderate liberal home ruler, was deeply shocked by the virulence of many Protestant clergy and the forbearance of the Catholic population of the North in the face of that onslaught. Connolly was indignant at the proposal to leave the Home Rule minority, quote, at the mercy of an ignorant majority with the evil record of the Orange Party. Little of the role of the churches has been properly explored by historians. Nowadays, in some quarters, the Home Rule Party is extolled as the essence of democracy, in contrast to the republicanism that emerged from 1916. The modern word for home rule is, of course, devolution, now working well in Scotland and Wales and waiting to be restored in Northern Ireland. Arguably, it could and should have represented an historic compromise between unionism and nationalism, home rule taking place within the context of the Union, the act of which would not even have needed to be repealed. Some explaining has to be done as to why that cause, or rather stopping it, justified civil war if necessary. Hysteria was whipped up in north-east Ulster. Carson denounced Home Rule on a platform as, quote, the most nefarious conspiracy that has ever been hatched against a free people. Privately, he wrote to Lady Londonderry, how I long to see Home Rule defeated. It is, I think, a passion with me. I cannot bear the hypocrisy of so-called political toleration. The Asquith government was ludicrously described by Carson as, quote, a revolutionary committee which has seized upon despotic power by fraud, an allusion, among other things, to the removal of the absolute veto power of the House of Lords. And although he wasn't a member, he was certainly a last-ditcher to the end. The Ulster Covenant of 1912 is an absolutely anti-democratic document, which compares very poorly as a foundation document with the 1916 proclamation. It does not concede so much as an inch of legitimacy to the democratically backed demand for self-government in any other part of Ireland going back to the time of O'Connell. It simply states, quote, home rule would be disastrous to the material well-being of Ulster as of the whole of Ireland, and speaks baldly of using, quote, all means which may be found necessary to defeat the present conspiracy to set up a home rule parliament in Ireland. Lord Chancellor Fitzgibbon, too, regarded democracy as a subversive conspiracy. Many commentators today try to focus on what they regard as the reprehensible militarism of the republicanism that between 1916 and 1921 created this state. Yet prior to 1916, it was the Ulstermen who were proud to be the fighters, the Prussians of Ireland. Ulster will fight and Ulster will be right, in contrast to the ineffectual, romantic Ireland dead and gone and presumed to be with John O'Leary in the grave. Protestant churchmen wax lyrical about making the ultimate sacrifice. Archbishop Bernard of Dublin, preaching at Christmas 1915, and note the date, referred to Home Rule and said, "The way of peace may be through war, even for the followers of the Prince of Peace." In the Irish Church Quarterly of April 1916, printed just before the Rising, W.S. Kerr wrote of Ulster, quote, "We who know her are thrilled by the spectacle of a law-abiding, industrious people preparing through fidelity to principle to make the ultimate sacrifice and committing their cause to the God of their fathers. Not too much wrong then with unionists sacrificing lives to prevent home rule. Nor much sign of the war having brought unionists and nationalists together as fondly imagined by neo-Redmondites today." The Irish Times of 1935, in contrast, took a thoroughly jaundiced view of the effects of Carson's pre-war actions, and I quote, "In the light of subsequent events, however, there can be little doubt that Lord Carson's campaign against Home Rule proved to have been a disservice to the cause to which he was so passionately loyal. When he decided to arm the Ulster Volunteers, and when his lieutenants ran their guns in such a spectacular manner on the Antrim coast, he hardly could have anticipated that his example would be followed very shortly by the political extremists in the south. He had hoped to keep Ireland in the British Empire, indeed within the United Kingdom, and to use force, if necessary, in pursuit of his ideal. The men who took their cue from him in the south were equally determined to remove Ireland from the empire and to use their guns against the British authorities. In the event, a wretched compromise was achieved. Ireland ran red with blood for 2 or 3 years, the Anglo-Irish Treaty was signed, and partition became an accomplished fact. We do not believe that Edward Carson ever desired partition, yet he remains as its supreme architect. He defied the law in the north in order to strengthen the imperial bond. Similar methods were employed in the south with precisely opposite aims, and the results are all too apparent today." End of quotation. As Owen McNeill entitled a fine famous pamphlet, "The North Began," it was E. Carson, not P. Pierce, who first mooted establishing a provisional government and making absolutely no bones about its illegality. If he had ever established it and occupied key buildings in Belfast, what British general would have been ordered to suppress the Rising? What gunships would have shelled the city and gutted the public buildings? And what firing squad would Carson, Craig, Crawford and other ringleaders have faced? As Roger Casement said at his trial to F.E. Smith, comparing treason, quote, "The difference between us was that the Unionist champions chose a path they felt would lead to the woolsack, while I went a road which I know must lead to the dock, or which I knew must lead to the dock." In the Irish Convention of 1917-18, Carson resisted strong pressure from Southern Unionists for compromise and acceptance of Home Rule for the island. Being at most prepared to concede as a fig leaf a Council of Ireland to run some residual joint services, an idea later converted by Unionists into a nationalist conspiracy. In an article in the Sunday Independent a couple of weeks ago, the next speaker, Ruth Dudley Edwards, made out that Carson wanted a united Ireland. Yes, that is true. A united Ireland as part of the United Kingdom with no home rule. Needless to say, one need not subscribe to the Irish Times' 1935 negative view of the struggle for independence and by implication of the Irish Free State, which incidentally was also the title of my father's first book in 1934 at the age of 24, much more positive in tone than the Irish Times editorial, but written by a young person from the same tradition with a respect and enthusiasm for the pioneering efforts of building a new state. A similar view was expressed by Dorothy McArdle, author of an immensely valuable source book with a foreword by Eamon de Valera, The Irish Republic. She was a teacher at Alexandra College, which, although a unionist educational establishment, kept her job open when she was imprisoned in Mountjoy in 1922. Towards the end of her life, she died in 1958, the rector of Raheny presiding at her funeral. She, along with others, including my father, contributed to a series of Thomas Davis lectures, in her case with a retrospective piece on Pearse and Connolly, published in a volume entitled The Shaping of Modern Ireland, edited by Conor Cruise O'Brien. She referred to problems in intervening decades as, quote, passing ills, and concluded, and I quote, Perhaps the existence of the sovereign independent Republic of Ireland might seem a sufficient, indeed a superb reward for all the toil and anxiety and sacrifice, despite its flaws. Defects we have in plenty, and we are not without being told about them. And are we not free, and is not a free-born generation preparing to take the future of the Republic into able and fruitful hands? It is argued that Ireland should have waited a generation and it would all have happened naturally, which is perhaps, to my way of thinking anyway, another way of saying that some other unfortunate country should have been left to do the independence fighting. Stanley Baldwin's dictum that there must not be another Ireland in India shows that those who fought in the independence struggle did a significant service to humanity. In 1920, Carson made an unforgivable incendiary speech which led to Catholic workers being driven out of the shipyards, and he often expressed the view that loyal Protestants should not have to work alongside disloyal Sinn Féiners, i.e. Catholics. He bitterly opposed the treaty and the whole notion of negotiating with terrorists, and claimed in the House of Lords treaty debate with false naivety that he had been betrayed by a purely power-seeking Tory party, rightly attracting the scorn of Lord Chancellor Lord Birkenhead F.E. Smith. One can, of course, also find many calmer, more conciliatory and constructive statements by Carson, but they did little to repair the damage done by the more incendiary ones. In later life, apart from a helpful intervention in the dispute over the Hugh Lane pictures, he acted as a postbox for disillusioned and unhappy erstwhile loyalist followers in the South, for whom he, perhaps rightly, felt some responsibility. Expressing the view in the late 1920s that a republic would be more honest did not stop him bitterly complaining in his last speech in the House of Lords on the 7th of December 1933 to the government as De Valera was dismantling the treaty, quote, "Every single promise you have made to the loyalists has been broken, and every pledge as to law and order has been destroyed. Everything that makes life and property safe has gone, and now the last remnant has been torn away." Maybe he was referring, among other things, to the appeal to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, which was being done away with. In the light of that, it's amazing that little more than a decade later, post-war, wealthy people emigrated from England to Ireland, seeking a safe haven from the 1945 Labour government and a socialist England, what my father used to call the retreat from Moscow. As Garrett Fitzgerald has pointed out, even Churchill at this period began to warm to Ireland. And all this would be very surprising if independent Ireland was as coldly inhospitable to Protestants as is sometimes made out. The main lines of the Irish Times 1935 editorial stand: that Carson's career was one of the tragedies of Irish history, that his histrionics were destructive, not least of community relations, that he destroyed both Redmond and Home Rule, and that while not desiring partition, he was the principal architect of it. The gamble of using North East Ulster to defeat or nullify Home Rule for the rest of Ireland failed. As I've said, it is not clear how far he reciprocated the pride in Northern Ireland that Unionist Northern Ireland clearly expressed in him. Unionists in the North, and nearly everyone in the South, are today strongly attached to the state to which they respectively belong. Without always caring too much about the pros and cons of how they arrived at their present constitutional position, if one wishes to be critical, the Ulster resistance to Home Rule is every bit as debatable as 1916 and the War of Independence. But whatever view one takes of any of these is not likely to alter very much what we have in both parts of the island today. Political accommodation has to proceed from where we are post-Good Friday Agreement rather than where any of us might wish to be if we could alter the outcomes of 80 to 90 years ago. Each section of the community must make its own analysis and future choices freely and without coercion. In my view, Carsonism was a failed attempt, conspiracy even, by reactionary interests exploiting popular sentiment in northeast Ulster to block even a limited form of self-government in Ireland, let alone a national democracy, with a separate Northern Ireland under its own version of Home Rule becoming the fallback position. In the short to medium term, post-1922, Ulster Unionists were insulated from the rest of Ireland, had only quite a large but seemingly impotent minority to contain. Cross-border challenges, political or paramilitary, were easily brushed off. A terrible retribution, to use a Gladstonian phrase, came with the civil rights movement, the collapse of stable majoritarian rule, and a bloody and deeply wrong attempt by an armed minority of a minority to achieve at one remove the physical coercion of a million people, little caring whether they stayed or went, which simply compounded the wrongs. Even today, walls are needed to protect communities from each other, and the legacy and persistence of division, which at this stage has a proliferation of causes, is not an uplifting sight. My own view, and I am speaking of the island as a whole, is that the Protestant tradition, including, where applicable, the Ulster British community, belongs with Ireland, that it should not be afraid of minority status, which should matter less and less in a modern pluralist and multicultural society, and should not be afraid of being unable to hold its own in a more accommodating and less farouche way. Within wide legal limits, people's choice of identity is their own. I do not believe in the permanence or even the full coherence of a two-nation dichotomy. Ireland, with or without Northern Ireland participation, now has an exciting future as an advanced European country with every prospect of enjoying a very high degree of prosperity and excellent quality of life. If a majority in Northern Ireland does not wish to participate, as they are free to do, the loss may be theirs as much as anyone else's, though their choices have unnecessarily penalised nationalists for over two generations, who would mostly much prefer, if their votes mean anything, to be an integral part of an independent Ireland. But the peace process, which has largely removed the physical and political threat, together with the very balanced Good Friday Agreement, opens up many halfway houses, accepting it may be much too soon to contemplate taking any fuller step, with so much bridge building in all directions needing to be undertaken. Whatever limited role I may have in public life, I would like to use in part working with others to encourage the sense of honour in the island-wide tradition to which my forefathers belonged, and to contribute to undoing some of the nefarious legacy of history left behind by Sir Edward Carson, who came from the south.
Senator Martin Manser on Edward Carson. Next week, Ruth Dudley Edwards tells us why she's less than enamoured of a nationalist icon, Constance Markiewicz.